Elektra is a dirty opera. It premiered in 1909, only 4 years after composer Richard Strauss's second opera, Salome, of which the centerpiece was a striptease performed by a murderous teenage heroine for her lecherous stepfather, the king. So I should clarify what I mean by dirty. Everyone in Elektra needs a bath. I should say everyone and everything. The opera opens with 5 palace servants actually mopping the courtyard of the royal palace. They are gossiping about the behavior of Elektra, who may be a royal princess, but who bears little resemblance to her Disney peers. The maids describe their encounters with Elektra, who is crazed by the death of her father, King Agamemnon, in animal terms. She is a wild cat, a snake, a dog. Elektra herself complains of the filth. The servants are, quote, stiff with dirt, unquote. The children are, quote, unclean, like dogs, walking upon the slippery, blood-stained steps of the palace. Complains may be too strong a word. Everything is carrion, beginning with Elektra herself. Away, foul flies, feed not on my sores, Elektra is quoted as saying. When one maid points out that Elektra is not dead, she still eats her meals, after all, the response is, 'tis a vulture whom I nourished. Elektra seems to revel in the filth. The apparently universal aversion to soap is a comment on what has happened in the palace before the opera began. King Agamemnon, leader of the Greek forces during the Trojan War, returned home. Having lived in a tent on the plains of Troy for 10 years, Agamemnon's first domestic act was, naturally, to take a bath. At which point his wife Clytemnestra and her lover Aegisthus cut him to pieces. No wonder Agamemnon's daughter is leery of the bathtub. Elektra is a story of emotion in its rawest forms, loss, hatred, but also longing and ecstasy. To make us feel these emotions, Austrian composer Richard Strauss and his librettist, the poet Hugo von Hofmannsthal, were going to have to get their hands dirty. But why would they want to? And even if they did want to, where were they going to find an audience for such electrifying stuff? If that sounds like a bad pun, I wish I had time to go into the etymology of electron, electricity, and Elektra. I don't, but you should look it up. Images of literally shell-shocked World War I soldiers emerging from their trenches color our understanding today of the early 20th century. But Strauss's opera premiered before that war began. This was still Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence. Who did Strauss think was going to buy tickets to his new opera? That poets like William Butler Yeats, who lived through the Great War, and Philip Larkin, who grew up in its aftermath, would retroactively christen the before time as pure is understandable. With Verdun ringing in one's ears, it was hard to remember that Edith Wharton's title was ironic. But it was. The public of the late 19th and early 20th century was not the public of Rossini, Verdi, or even of Richard Wagner. Romanticism had given way to a taste for the lurid and shocking. Plenty was available in the daily news. The Franco-Prussian War of 1870 instilled in the French a bloody desire to avenge the Prussian annexation of Alsace and Lorraine. Lizzie Borden's axe murder of her father and stepmother, and her subsequent trial and acquittal, were the cause célèbre of 1892 and 1893. Throughout the 1880s, London staggered under the brutal blows of Jack the Ripper. And the turn of the century was marked by the Boxer Rebellion of 1899 and the Russian Revolution of 1905. Literature and art either reflected or led a corresponding descent into Gothic horror. The fear inspired by the stories of Edgar Allan Poe, E.T.A. Hoffman, and Mary Shelley no longer thrilled. Instead, the public gulped down Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, H.G. Wells's The Island of Dr. Moreau, Anthony Hope's The Prisoner of Zenda, and Bram Stoker's Dracula. Dirt, violence, filth. This was what the public demanded. Shocks to the emotions. And in Elektra, Strauss meant to give it to them. Literally. Also, this being opera, after all, figuratively. But how was Strauss going to do this? The market was flooded then, as it is now, with the gripping and the grotesque. How do you even keep people's attention? Shortly after the opera's premiere, a cartoon was published showing the Greek tragedian Sophocles as an old man. Sophocles was the author of the Greek tragedy Electra, upon which the opera is based. In the cartoon, two young men dressed in 20th century evening dress are beating the old man. One, meant to depict librettist Hofmannsthal, has a grip on the old man's beard and is gouging out his eyes. The other, Strauss, is kicking him and striking him with percussion instruments. The cartoonist's contention that creating the opera was an artistic felony is grossly unfair. One can also take issue with the implication that art is defenseless, or that Sophocles never portrayed an impure thought. But it's hard to argue against the assertion that Strauss was taking a stick to the musical conventions of his time. Strauss intended to grab his audience by delivering the kind of visceral jolt they craved. To do this, he needed to serve up a bloody stew of the familiar and the unknown. Gothic horror had succeeded by defacing the platonic beauties of the romantic poets, but what was the musical equivalent of dirt and violence? The answer was dissonance. A musician may tell you that dissonance has a precise meaning. It's a lack of harmony, the tension between two elements that are not meant to go together. Getting more technical, they might say it's the simultaneous sounding of specific combinations of notes, and that the disharmony heard by the ear is a reaction to the ratio of the frequency of the notes not having certain precise mathematical values. This is one of those things where you can be technically correct and yet miss the point entirely. All music has dissonance. Well, all the music you want to listen to, Pachelbel is on his own. The way you know the opera or symphony has ended, besides the clapping, is that the composer resolves the dissonances. Your ears and brain get a rest from the emotional tension dissonance causes. But ears are like eyes. They adapt to and ultimately stop noticing that in a red room, take for example the Lyric Opera House, everything in the room takes on a reddish tint. Bach and Mozart used dissonance, but as their tricks for creating dramatic tension became familiar to audiences, the effect was lessened. Composers realized that the dissonance had to be turned up to get the same effect. Beethoven was accused of being excessively dissonant. So were Berlioz, Wagner, Stravinsky, and Schoenberg. Some of them still are. I mention this because Electra may well not sound dissonant to you 110 years after it was written. These days we tend to hear the great beauty of Strauss's scores and miss the sections that were meant to sound ugly, to cause dramatic tension. I ask you to listen with fresh ears. If you can hear the ugly, the dirty moments in the opera, you will see how it both heightens the beautiful ones and increases the emotional tension. The opera opens with a brutal fanfare. Let's listen first to the fanfare itself, and then to the underlying notes played together on a piano. When Richard Strauss is beating you with a stick, you may not be inclined to look on the bright side, and I'm certainly torturing this metaphor. But another way to look at it is that Strauss and Hofmannsthal were very aware that they were standing on the shoulders, or maybe the stomach or the head, of those who went before them. Strauss wanted to convey the raw emotion of his story, and doing that meant using the familiar as well as the unfamiliar. Electra is an homage to the history of opera and drama. It squeezes every remaining ounce of life out of centuries of tradition and convention. That dissonant opening chord is the musical kernel of the entire opera. It's known as the Electra chord, partly for that reason, and partly as a nod to another famous chord that birthed an opera, Wagner's Tristan chord. The score uses another Wagnerian device, the leitmotif, in which musical themes are associated with specific people, places, or ideas. By Electra's premiere, this was an old idea, nearing its 60th birthday, even if you believe that Wagner's idea was original. The use of a classical Greek source for an opera plot was even older, dating back to the first operas ever written. Jacopo Peri's Daphne of 1598, his later opera Eurydice, and Claudio Monteverdi's Orfeo. 18th-century Italian opera seria all but mandated a classical source, so much so that composers and audiences eventually rebelled, turning to contemporary stories they felt were more relevant to their times. By 1909, the convention had been abandoned for so long that Hofmannsthal could say he was doing something new by reclaiming it. And the story itself was both ancient and foundational. The tragedy of Electra is one of the cornerstones of Greek mythology, a multi-generational epic that Aeschylus would tell in three plays, his so-called Oresteia. The Oresteia was named for Electra's brother, Orestes, who will kill his mother, Clytemnestra, at the end of the opera. The trilogy demonstrates why retributive justice, an eye for an eye, doesn't work as a basis for human justice. Orestes' matricide is justified as retribution for the killing of Agamemnon. But Clytemnestra's crime, killing her husband, was retribution for Agamemnon sacrificing their daughter Iphigenia before he left for the Trojan War. And Iphigenia's sacrifice was retribution demanded by the goddess Artemis for Agamemnon killing a deer that belonged to her. One almost expects to learn that the deer was guilty of slapping a bunny, and that the bunny ate a forbidden carrot. The point is that without an Athena to step in, the cycle becomes increasingly bloody and never ends. Operas also tend to be bloody and endless, although at 110 minutes, Electra is unusually short. Another way in which Strauss was doing something new by doing something old was in choosing a story that conformed to the so-called Aristotelian unities. This was a long-forgotten set of rules from Aristotle's Poetics about what made for good drama. A good drama, Aristotle decreed, should have unity of action, unity of time, and unity of place. In other words, the action should not be broken up by endless complicated subplots, it should not cover the events of more than 24 hours, and it should stay in one location. For opera, these were very practical dictums. Opera sets are heavy and hard to move. Singing text slows things down to the point that you can't cram in a lot of extraneous material. And flashbacks on stage, where we can't make the screen all wavy or sepia-toned to show that this is the past, are just confusing. Electra the opera displays all three Aristotelian unities, possibly the only opera to do so between 1750 and its premiere. The trend had been in the opposite direction, towards what we might call the Odyssean disunities, which would be wandering all over the place, lost for 10 years. Possibly in a boat overcrowded with choristers, corps de ballet, compromarios, and theorbo players. Of all Strauss's borrowings to construct Electra, the most prominent may be the debt he owes to Fin de Siècle's Vienna and its obsession with obsession. Sigmund Freud was a neighbor of Hofmannsthal's in Vienna, and Freud had published his groundbreaking Studies in Hysteria in 1895 and The Interpretation of Dreams in 1900. Electra is depicted as an animal because to medicine and psychiatry, also to zoology, humans are animals, poked and prodded by their fears, their hates, and their obsessions. But by reminding us, Strauss and Hofmannsthal were dragging us back to dirty, gritty, emotional earth. Electra's obsession is her father's murder, which she recounts in gory detail in an 8-minute monologue. Agamemnon was survived by 3 children, or 4 if you believe the version in which Artemis changed her mind and whisked Iphigenia away before the axe fell. Only 2 are living at home, Electra and her sister Chrysotomus, Orestes having found it a bit too hot in the palace. Chrysotomus warns Electra to flee before their mother and her lover lock Electra up. Her warning is not altruistic. Chrysotomus cannot bring herself to leave Electra behind, but she herself desperately wants to leave. The palace is a place of death and evil memories, and she wants to live. More specifically, she wants to have a baby and be a mother, an emotion she conveys with an obsessive intensity equal to Electra's. That all of Strauss and Hofmannsthal's women in the opera are quite literally hysterics requires some examination by a modern audience. We cannot credit either man with a forward-looking attitude towards women. Chrysotomus's desire to be a mother is presented and meant as the proper apotheosis of female ambition. This is even more evident in Strauss and Hofmannsthal's later collaboration, Die Frau und der Schatten. But the context of Elektra, a brutal mariticide, that means murdering your husband, covers up this blemish. Chrysotomus wants a normal life. Instead, she's in constant fear for her own life, wandering around the crime scene where her father was butchered. And the only person she has to talk to, her little sister, is clearly bonkers. You'd be hysterical, too. Enter the third woman of the story, their mother Clytemnestra. The queen has been unable to sleep, haunted by gruesome dreams, and she asks Electra's advice. Make a sacrifice to the gods, Electra counsels. Remember that this being ancient Greece, this is a reasonable, balanced suggestion. One makes sacrifices to the gods continually, to grant favors, lift bans, and generally solve problems. One wonders why the queen is not more suspicious of her daughter. But she explains that Electra's honesty, brutal as it is still more palatable than the lying fawning of her courtiers. The queen is intrigued by Electra's suggestion and asks for details. The explanation, of course, is that Electra is looking forward to the time when Clytemnestra herself will be sacrificed by her son Orestes. Not quite the solution the queen was looking for. A courtier enters and gives the queen news which makes her laugh. What could it be? Two newcomers have brought news of Orestes' death, trampled by his own horses. While Electra contemplates the duty of revenge that now falls on her alone, she meets one of the messengers. It is Orestes himself, but she doesn't recognize him. Listen to the emotional pivot in this next excerpt. It reminds me of the end of the first act of Die Walküre, when Siegmund and Sieglinde declare their love and decide to run away together. Except that is not Electra expressing joy that her brother is alive. Here is Electra's response when she finally realizes the man before her is her brother. As you heard, Electra screams arrest and is then struck dumb. The orchestra continues to play alone for 64 seconds, an eternity in a live performance. She is momentarily overcome that her brother is alive, not dead. But what fills her with joy, the ecstasy we heard in the previous excerpt, is the thought that her brother is going to avenge their father by killing their mother with an axe. The axe that was used to butcher their father, and which Electra collected and hid, so it could be used for this purpose. This is humanity in its rawest form, and it makes for a gripping performance. Strauss ends his opera with an emotional tour de force taken straight out of Sophocles. Greek aesthetics dictated that the actual violence happen offstage. It was not that they were afraid to get their hands dirty. Go back and read some of the plays of Aeschylus or Euripides, or Sophocles. They were knee-deep in gore. but they were convinced that it was much more frightening to stoke the audience's own imagination, with offstage sounds of confusion and violence, with descriptions of the aftermath, and by seeing the emotional turmoil on the face of a witness or survivor. A prop dagger and ketchup just doesn't compare. Something movies don't seem yet to have learned. Electra holds a torch for her stepfather Aegisthus and lights his way into the house. She is giddy with anticipation. The door is shut and we soon hear the tumult within. While that's going on, Electra dances. You know what's happened and what's going on, but pay attention during the ending because it's every bit as shocking as what's gone before. First, Electra drops dead at the end of the opera. This was not in the Sophocles original, but it makes sense. The creature we have been watching on stage, what does she have to live for after her life's work has been accomplished? Second, listen for that crashing Electra chord and the tension and pain it encapsulates. It rears up like the twitches of a dying animal. And third, when I spoke about dissonance before, I said that it was there so the composer could release the accumulated tension when it resolved. But Strauss doesn't want you to go home comforted. This is a tragedy, so he can't release all the tension. I think you will find Electra gripping and challenging, as Strauss intended, but also emotional and beautiful. Thank you for listening. Lyrics commentaries are made possible through the generous support of the Patrick G. and Shirley Welsh Ryan Foundation in memory of their parents. The music you have heard is generously furnished by Warner Classics and is available for purchase on iTunes.